Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken? A podcast from Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode, a conversation with Dean Susan Fournier, where she answers the question at the heart of the show.
I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store. This is On Point. It's nearly 4 months since Russia invaded Ukraine. While Ukrainians who fled the capital Kyiv have slowly been returning, the situation in eastern Ukraine is very different. The sound of fighting just a few days ago in Severodonetsk, a city in the far east. Russia has been intensifying its attack there as it slowly, very slowly, takes more ground. Look at a live map of the conflict, like the one produced by the Institute for the Study of War, and you'll see a crescent of red in Ukraine's east, sweeping from Kherson in the south, through Melitopol and Mariupol in the middle, up and around to the suburbs of Kharkiv in the north. That crescent represents all the territory that Russia has taken from Ukraine since the war began. Earlier this month, President Zelensky estimated that Russia now occupies 20% of his country. Russian-backed forces occupied part of the east before the war, but that territory has now tripled. President Zelensky has made clear that he wants that Red Crescent gone, and his forces are continuing to try to push the Russians out. But by his government's own estimate, that is costing the lives of 200 Ukrainian soldiers every day. Ukraine can only succeed with the help of the U.S. and its Western allies. Help in the form of weapons, of money, of humanitarian support, of political backing, of sanctions on Russia. The question is, how much longer can we give that backing? Is there a time to tell President Zelensky to swallow his losses, celebrate his unlikely survival, get to the negotiating table, end the war, and start rebuilding what's left of his country? The historian Anne Applebaum is a staff writer at The Atlantic and a senior fellow at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies, and she's in Warsaw. Anne, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
So you have said that the U.S. and its Western allies must win the war in Ukraine. What does winning mean to you? Explain that.
Let me start by challenging a little bit the presentation of the war that you just gave, because it implied that there is an amount of territory we could give the Russians that would satisfy them and that would somehow preserve Ukraine. I'm not sure that's true. As far as I can tell, the Russians have not changed their goal in Ukraine. Their goal is still to conquer the entire country. Even if they were to stop, if there were to be a ceasefire for some period of time, there's no guarantee that they wouldn't continue it. Therefore, this is a kind of false idea that there's some land we could give them that would somehow preserve Zelensky and preserve some part of Ukraine, and there's really no evidence for that. That means that any conclusion to the war in Ukraine has to end with the Russians out of Ukraine, at least up to the borders as they were on February the 24th, and some kind of guarantee that that the war won't continue, whether that's a NATO presence in Ukraine, whether it's a security guarantees of a different kind, whatever it is, for Ukraine to remain a stable, viable state, there has to be some belief that it won't be invaded again sometime soon. And that's what victory has to look like.
So talk a little bit about the interests of, obviously, the United States and its Western allies have an interest in stopping Vladimir Putin, but they don't all see the way to stop him or the way to end this war in the same way. You have those farther, the Western allies farther to the east that are saying essentially what you're saying, that Putin has to be pushed out, Russian forces have to be pushed out and punished. But then in the West, you have other countries that want a quick end to this. And if that means some short-term pact or armistice that can bring it into that, that's better. Talk about the difference in the interest and where the U.S. fits in, do you think?
So I think that the difference is between people who understand Russia and people who don't understand Russia, and people who understand that the goal of Russia is to dominate Ukraine and eventually possibly more countries, and those who still live in a fantasy world where they believe that the Russians are nice and they're reasonable and they will eventually see some kind of rational solution to this war and we can go back trading with them like we used to do. I'm afraid that is the line between it doesn't just run through Europe, it runs through almost every European country, and it runs through Washington as well. It's the realistic, honest understanding of the war is an understanding that we now face a country that is revanchist, that seeks to expand its territory for ideological reasons, that wishes to end the American presence in Europe, that wishes to end the European Union, that wishes to undermine NATO, and has a fundamentally different view of the world from the one that we have. And as I said, not everybody understands that. Not everybody wants to accept that. It's a very unpleasant thing to come to realize, because it means that we have to make big changes in the way we think about Europe and the way we think about security and so on. But that's the fundamental difference here.
And one question looming over this process is what victory means for Ukraine and whether its goals are realistic. Here's President Zelensky speaking to the Financial Times on June 7th. His words are spoken by an interpreter.
Independence, in my opinion, and in the opinion of most of our people, is regaining all of our territories, restoring our territorial integrity and the inviolable sovereignty of Ukraine. As of now, I can say that restoring the borders that we controlled before 24th of February is a serious temporary victory. Temporary because we indeed have to achieve a full deoccupation of our entire territory.
And how realistic do you think it is to reach that goal? I mean, even before February, Russia had already encroached on Ukraine in Crimea. How realistic is it to say that you can have a full deoccupation?
I mean, you know, it depends on your time frame. But I mean, certainly I believe that it's possible to return to the borders of February the 24th, yes, and to that status quo. The Ukrainians think they can do it if they have the sufficient weapons and if they have the sufficient support. I mean, I've repeat again, you know, be careful what assumptions you're making. Allowing the Russians to keep territory doesn't mean that the war will end. It doesn't mean that a deal will be done. It doesn't mean that Putin has given up on his goal either of occupying Kiev or of his goals of, you know, which he mentioned a couple of days ago, reestablishing the borders of the Soviet Union, which would include at least the Baltic states and maybe Eastern Europe, maybe Poland, maybe Romania, who knows, even Eastern Germany. And so you have to understand what kind of a country we're now dealing with and what its ambitions are. And the question is whether we halt those ambitions now in Ukraine or whether we halt them later in the suburbs of Warsaw.
So I want to ask a little bit about what history teaches us in this moment. I mean, as I've mentioned, the annexation of Crimea, for example, shows that giving Vladimir Putin an inch just encourages him to take a mile. But how can you stop he's stated, as you said, his strong desire to reassemble the Soviet bloc and beyond? Even if there is a victory declared here in the way that you set it out, how does that ensure that this won't just keep happening?
Well, during the Cold War, we used a thing called deterrence. And the idea of deterrence was that we built up sufficient weapons and a sufficient, mostly American, though not entirely, also European military presence in Berlin, in Germany, in Western Europe. And the deterrence was sufficient so that the Soviet Union was afraid to invade or didn't want to invade because the price would be too high. Thinking along those lines, again, is what we're going to need to do now. at least until there's a different kind of government in Russia with different goals. But at least for the moment, what we need to do is deter the Russians. And that means, as I say, building up once again an American and a European military presence. As I said, this is a very uncomfortable and unpleasant thing to have to do. Nobody wanted to do this. Everybody was very happy when the Cold War ended because it meant that we would get a peace dividend. People could come home. We could think about other things. We could focus on other parts of the world. I understand all those sentiments. I shared them myself. But we are now in a new phase, and it's important to begin to think once again about how do we deter an aggressive military power.
And how exactly do you do that? Is it with the increase in heavy weapons? It seems that sanctions and other diplomatic means have not been very successful.
No, sanctions don't work in the short term. That's clear, and that's everybody knew that was the case. But you know, of course, it's the hope in the long term that the sanctions will, if nothing else, they will undermine Russia's ability to rearm itself. And then some of the sanctions, in particular, there's some particularly aimed at particular exports, in particular, chips and so on. Some of those things are aimed directly at the Russian military industry with the hope that it will not be able to reconstitute itself. So sanctions will not, of course, they will not work in the next 3 months, but the hope is that they will work over the next 3 years, or at least they will help. The idea is to make it impossible for Russia to invade because Russia will know that it will lose. And so, you know, as I said, this isn't rocket science, to make a maybe not a very good pun, but this isn't we've done it before. It's not intellectually difficult to understand. What we need to do is to raise the price of Russian invasion, the economic price, the political price, and the military price.
Well, when we come back, we will continue our conversation about the case for negotiating an end to the war in Ukraine, and we'll have a chance to hear the view from Kyiv. I'm Kimberly Atkins-Storr. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. These days, it's hard to ignore the debate over the role business should play in society.
There's crescendo around profit, period. Is profit bad? Is capitalism evil? These themes are out there.
Is this criticism of business warranted? And if so, how do we fix it? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode of the Is Business Broken podcast.
Welcome back to On Point. I'm Kimberly Atkins-Storr. Today we're asking if, when, and how the U.S. might encourage Ukraine to make peace with Vladimir Putin's Russia. With me is the historian and writer for The Atlantic, Anne Applebaum. And also joining us is Stephen Simon. He is the Robert E. Willem Fellow at MIT Center for International Studies. He was previously a career State Department diplomat and senior director at the National Security Council under President Obama. Stephen, I want to come to you. Anne and I have been discussing her view that a clear victory is really the only solution, the only way to win this war. But you advocate for something else. You called it a negotiated armistice that facilitates a diplomatic solution. Explain how you think this war can end.
Well, continued conflict is going to destroy Ukraine without dislodging the Russians. So I think it's in everyone's interest to seek a diplomatic solution, some negotiated solution. As for what it would look like, most analysts who've been looking at this think that the solution will look something like Minsk 3, you know, a reiteration or updating of the Minsk agreement that fell apart prior to the launch of this war by Russia. And that would essentially, in the view of those who think about these diplomatic arrangements, it would entail some pledge by Ukraine of neutrality in return for the phased withdrawal of Russian forces from Ukraine, or at least from Luhansk and Donetsk, which is what most people have been thinking of as against, say, Crimea, which is, you know, also an issue. It's also a part of Ukraine that has been occupied since 2014 by the Russians. There are plenty of models for how this would be handled in diplomatic terms. And of course, you know, foreign ministries are paid to dream up these kinds of arrangements. The ones that come to mind for me mostly stem, say, from the 1973 war between Egypt and Israel and Syria and Israel, where after the war, there were separation of forces agreements that were negotiated by the United States that led to phased withdrawals of military forces from the borders. They were confidence-building measures, and they were also intended, of course, to make it more difficult for either side in the conflict to restart the war. And one can see an arrangement of this sort implemented in the Ukrainian-Russian context. I mean, there were other models, too. Limitations on conventional forces in Europe that were negotiated. It seems like ancient history now, but they were negotiated in the 1990s, are another format, because these impose the limits on the kinds of weapons and vehicles that possible potential combatants or past combatants could deploy in areas where they could actually be used to start a war, prosecute a war against the other side. So, there are ways to do this, but nothing can be done until the two sides sit down at the table and there are concerned outside states to broker the talks. So,
well, Stephen, let me ask you this. How can the United States and allies broker that kind of agreement when even they don't all agree? A lot of the Central and Eastern European allies, particularly those in the former Soviet bloc, say defeating Russia is the only way to prevent Putin from achieving his goals of reestablishing his former sphere of influence. Can Putin be trusted at the negotiating table?
Well, that's, the trust issue is an important one, obviously. It's key. But that's why parties to these kinds of negotiations adopt a phased framework, a phased approach. So the one side is obligated to do X. If they do it, then the other side does Y. And if the other side completes Y to the satisfaction of the first side, well, then you can take it from there. If at any point one or another side doesn't live up to its obligations, then progress halts and, the two sides can revert to the status quo ante, to the situation as it existed beforehand. So a phased approach affords leverage for both sides to ensure that the other side complies with its responsibilities. And it sort of rules out, the need for trust, some sort of, metaphysical or spiritual bond with the other party. Now, nobody's going to have that. I think the phased approach really deals with that problem. The other thing, as far as winning this war, as you were channeling the Central and Eastern European states on this issue, I think it's beyond the capacity of Ukraine to win the war, if winning the war means expelling Russian forces from Ukrainian territory through the use of force, you know, pushing them back, using, you know, superior strategy and military means, strategic and military means. I don't think that they can do that. And if they can't do it, and every day they keep trying, more of Ukraine gets destroyed, the more of Ukraine will have to be rebuilt once the conflict ends. And it will probably end with some kind of negotiated arrangement. So since the meter is running, it's best to get started on this now.
I want to give Anne a chance to respond to that. What do you think, Anne?
So I think it's obvious that eventually this will end with a negotiated settlement, maybe even of the kind that we're discussing. The trouble is that's not going to be possible until the Russians give up their goal, which is to destroy all of Ukraine and to occupy all of Ukraine and to turn it into a Russian satrapy. And as far as I can see, they have not given up that goal yet. And so I don't understand what is the, you know, what kind of a negotiation we can have until that happens. If the Ukrainians were to stop fighting, then the only thing that would happen would be that the Russians would move forward further.
So Anne and Stephen, we'll come back to you. Please stay with us. But I want to take a moment here to get the view from Ukraine itself. Ivana Klimpush-Tinsatse is a member of the Ukrainian Parliament from the opposition European Solidarity Party and chair of the Parliament's Committee on Integration with the European Union. She is in Kyiv. Ivana, I wonder what you make of the conversation that you've heard so far.
Hi, Kim. Thank you very much for having me. Well, obviously, we Ukrainians here understand that this for us is the war for survival. And I would probably continue the phrase that Anne started to say, that if we Ukrainians would stop fighting, we would just cease to exist as a country and as a nation. And that is part of the goal that Putin has been clear about, because he wants to erase us from the map of the world. So therefore, there is no really room for compromise, and talking about sides complying to their responsibility, you know, we just go back even watching the history of this war, of 8 years of history of this war, where Russia did not comply to any of its promises, to any of the signed agreements or these negotiations that were held with the Russian Federation. So we here understand that our resources are scarce, that our resolve and our courage is definitely incredible, and I think it has made the whole world it has astonished the whole world. But at the same time, we understand that we are fighting to ensure that principles of the international law, the existing system of checks and balances somehow has to be pre-existing, has to be restored. And that means that countries, members of the free world, would have to back us up. And that's why we believe that we are totally dependent on urgency, quality, and quantity of the weaponry that we are going to be provided in order to push Russians out. But that's the only way for us to survive. Otherwise, any stop in this war, any discussion, any negotiation at this particular point would mean that Russians are using that chance to regroup and attack again, as they are there with their imperial goal to restore this kind of sick understanding of history, to restore some type of Russian empire, whether within the USSR borders or whether within the Russian empire, Tsarist Russian empire borders.
Yeah, so I want to get your view about what those in the West who are pushing for something else, pushing for a compromise or warning against escalation, such as Macron has worried that humiliating Russia would be a bad way to go because it would risk escalation. What is it about the situation there in Ukraine that you think those leaders don't understand?
Well, you see, when some of the Western leaders are saying about humiliating Russia, I always just get back to history of World War II. And I wonder whether anyone has been talking about possibility of non-humiliation of the Nazi Germany. I think that we are dealing with the same type of the state and the same type of the management of this state. I don't want to call to use even the word leader of the state, and that why this state understand only the language of force, of unity, and of strength. And that is the only way how to stop this particular disease from spreading further across the world. He's not definitely going to stop with the with even conquering the whole Ukraine, but he is just proving what Russian Federations, whatever the name of the state was in the previous years and centuries, history is telling us. This is the way of life of Russia. To fight conquering wars, to expand, and not to raise the way of life of people, or to provide for their prosperity. It's about conquering additional lands which they've decided that are theirs. So, from my perspective, I think. At this particular moment, it is important not to humiliate all those victims and all those losses that Ukrainians have already paid for in this war, for our ability to live, for our ability to build the country in accordance to our dream. And that means respecting this desire and the right of Ukrainian state and Ukrainian nation to exist in the whole world. So I think we have tried out already all the possibilities of appeasement, or not us, but I mean the our colleagues and our partners from the EU, and it's time to understand that mistakes of the West, starting from Bucharest summit of NATO back in 2008, not granting map to Ukraine and Georgia, then pitiful and weak reaction to attack in Georgia, then really weak sanctions with regard to annexation of Crimea, all of those things, they actually have paved the way for Russian Federation to raise their appetite and to attack mm-hmm. with more strength.
All right. Ivana Klimpush-Tsintsatse is chair of the Ukrainian Parliament's Committee on Integration with the European Union. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
So I want to get the reaction from Stephen and Anne. Stephen, first, what is your reaction?
Thanks. On the question of, you know, Putin's objectives and all that, what his goals are, as Anne put them, I think just as Ukraine lacks the capacity to achieve its goals, I think the Russians lack the capacity to achieve theirs, which is, of course, why we're looking at the impasse that we're seeing on the ground, the very bloody impasse. You know, my concern as an American, I suppose, is that, you know, these wars of attrition, the kind that we're seeing develop now and unfold now on the ground in Ukraine, create a kind of unstable equilibrium. And the longer they go on, the greater the incentive for one side or another to escalate, in other words, to break the stalemate. And you know, dealing with a country like Russia, and I agree with Ivana's characterization of the current Russian government. When you're dealing with such a government that has nuclear weapons and has tacitly threatened to use them, one doesn't want to get into a situation where America's and NATO's Ukrainian partner in this conflict decides it's going to break the stalemate and try and go for it in a way that could trigger a larger war. I mean, already we're seeing horizontal escalation. That is to say, you know, the Russians are now look as though they're going after Americans who are deployed to Syria. They're going to use whatever leverage they can. So the best thing really to avoid a drastic escalation that can happen very, very swiftly and, and without the foreknowledge of NATO or the United States, the best way to do that is to opt for a negotiated settlement. Now, that.
Well, I just want to give Anne a chance to react before the break. Go ahead, Anne.
Okay, sure.
I remain confused about why it's thought that there is a possibility of a negotiated settlement right now. I just don't see any evidence that the Russians want it. And I don't see that until they begin to lose, until they begin to have to withdraw from territory that they've occupied in this war, until that happens, I don't see that they're going to stop fighting. And so an element of realism is needed here.
All right, Anne Applebaum and Stephen Simon, stay with us. We'll continue our conversation about the war in Ukraine and its ultimate goals when we come back. I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store. Tomorrow, from reinfections to vaccines for children under five, we'll talk about the latest news on COVID. What questions do you have? And share with us your experience about experiencing a reinfection or about what the wait for the latest vaccines for our youngest was like. Call us at 617-353-0683. That's 617-353-0683. Today, we're looking at the case for negotiating an end to the war in Ukraine. With me are historian Anne Applebaum and Stephen Simon from MIT's Center for International Studies. In the time that we have left, I'd like to ask you both about what would need to happen, about what the U.S. would need to do to ensure a lasting peace in Ukraine, because there was a peace deal between Ukraine and Russia once before. Two deals, in fact, signed in 2014 and 2015 in the Belarusian capital Minsk. The deal was, in essence, that Ukraine would stop fighting Russian-backed forces in the east in exchange for assurances that Russia wouldn't take any further territory. Suffice it to say, it didn't work as intended. So if Ukraine is to come to the table again, it's made clear that a Minsk-style deal isn't enough. Instead, it needs much greater guarantees that nothing like this invasion will ever happen again, and it needs to know that peace will come with big benefits, like membership in the EU. So, Anne, what would a peace deal need to look like for it to make sense to Ukraine?
So, as we've already discussed, it would have to come with some kind of security guarantee, whether that's a NATO presence in Ukraine, whether it's NATO membership, whether Ukraine is officially neutral but belongs to some other security institution that we create, it doesn't really matter. But there has to be a belief among Ukrainians, among potential foreign investors, among refugees that it's worth coming back, it's worth investing, it's worth rebuilding the country because the war is over. And that is the however the war ends and wherever the border will be, that's absolutely crucial. And so therefore, We need to be sure that the Russians are not going to renew their goal of eradicating the country and erasing it from the map, you know, or making it so unviable that it can't survive. And so that has to, that is a kind of, that's really the bottom line. And it's when, once we do that, we will then also have achieved something else, which is that we will then have a Russia which has given up at least some of its imperial ambitions, some of its desire to recreate an empire, you know, some of its colonial attitudes towards Ukraine.
And Stephen, how much time does the U.S. and its allies have time, have left to decide what approach to take?
Well, you know, as I said before, the meter is running. And because with every day, more of Ukraine is destroyed, its infrastructure, and its people. People are dying. It's thought at the rate of 200 a day, so 1,400 casualties a week, civilian and military. That's going to create not just an economic problem, but a demographic problem. As setting aside for the moment the just the human tragedy of it. So, yeah. You know, I think this has to stop sooner rather than later. Also, Western, I think, interest in this conflict is going to diminish over time. The EU, I think, is going to have a problem sustaining the support that it's demonstrated thus far for Ukraine. And in the United States, well, you know, people will move on. The U.S. has a track record of developing a serious case of fatigue with its support for these sorts of conflicts. And the United States doesn't have a really direct interest in Ukraine, a strategic interest in Ukraine. So it's problematic. So the sooner that some negotiated settlement is achieved, the better for all concerned. Now,
and it's not just a matter of the actual impact that you're saying from the war, but also the humanitarian impact. Early in the war, the focus was naturally on the humanitarian disaster taking place inside Ukraine. But the war is beginning to have a devastating impact on the poorest of the poor the world over. Ukraine is one of the world's most crucial breadbaskets, and the war has cut it off from those who need it most. Here's the president of the World Food Program, David Beasley, speaking last month.
It's hard to believe that Ukraine, a nation that grows enough grain to feed 400 million people, is now out of production. Mr. Secretary, it's critical that these farms get back in operation, that the trucks and the trains and the ships move again. The World Food Program, we fed about 130 million people last year, assisted in some way or another. This year, we expect that number to be about 150. 50% of the grains that we buy come from Ukraine.
Now, the main reason for the shortages is that Russia is blocking Ukraine's main port, Odessa. So in the end, a resolution to the grain crisis is up to Vladimir Putin. But it doesn't. But doesn't the U.S. hold some responsibility and to encourage the Ukraine to negotiate with him, or so that these ports can be reopened and the world's poorest can be saved from famine?
I am honestly confused why you keep repeating the same idea that if we negotiate with Russia, that we will end the war or that we will release the port of Odessa. Russia does not want to end the war. They are not interested in negotiation. We need to make we need to get them to the point where they are interested, and then maybe it will happen. And this is really an exercise in wishful thinking of a kind that's really quite dangerous. You know, I agree with you that the impact on the world is going to be horrendous. It's already bad. And this is something that the Russians know and are encouraging. They want there to be an international famine. Their leading spokeswoman said this yesterday. They're hoping that there will be a famine, that people will die, that there will be a refugee crisis. They are interested in destabilizing Europe, and they're interested in destabilizing the West. This is not a country that cares very much about the well-being of people around the world, especially the poor in Africa and the Middle East. So don't think that you can persuade them by talking to them that this would be a good idea. I mean, there is a potential different solution, which would be that the World Food Program, together with the Turks, I don't know, the French, the Egyptians, and others, could create a passageway, a blockade in the Black Sea, that, and they could then demine the port of Odessa, and they could then ship out grain that way. And I know there are behind-the-scenes conversations about that. So far, nobody has yet, they haven't finalized it, they haven't agreed to do it. But I just don't believe that the Russians are going to somehow say, oh, we're so sorry, there are a lot of people who are starving, therefore we're going to stop fighting the war. They're saying exactly the opposite right now, every day.
So, Anna, I sense your frustration here, but so it's not just me making points about compromise. It's also some of the Western leaders. So what do you, I asked Ivana, what is it that they're not understanding on the ground clearly, or what is it about the interest that they have that is making them more reluctant to dig in and push for full defeat? And what do you say to them?
So their interests are clear. Their interests, of course, they're interested in ending the war. Of course, nobody likes the war. Of course, they want oil prices to go back down. Of course, they want to renew normal trade. It's understandable, but it's you know, but we can't get there if we're going to base our policy on wishful thinking about what we hope the Russians will do. Right now, we don't have any evidence that they want to do anything that we want them to do. And so we need to base our policy on a realistic assessment of what's happening on the ground, what more we can do to help, and how we can persuade the Russians to stop fighting, because it will no longer be in their interest to do so. But right now, we're not yet at the stage where they're willing to stop. And so until we're there, I don't see that it's a useful conversation to have. It will be useful one day. I hope there's a negotiated solution. I want the war to end. I want the destruction of Ukraine to end as fast as possible. But I don't think that telling the Ukrainians to stop fighting or to give up some piece of territory means that the destruction will end. It simply means that the Russians will push in farther, take more land, murder more people, create more concentration camps, deport more Ukrainians, and so on. You're talking about a demographic crisis. The Russians have deported possibly as many as 1 million people from Ukraine. A million people. Think about that. So this is the crisis is not over because we wishfully hope that it will be over.
Okay. So as you pointed out, Vladimir Putin began this war with grand imperial ambitions, ideas about bringing Ukraine into what he sees as its rightful place as part of Russia. The question is whether those ambitions have been snuffed out or whether a peace deal could give time to recover. Well, earlier this week at a summit in St. Petersburg, President Putin seemed to indicate that the views that led him to invade Ukraine have not disappeared. Here is a translation of what he's saying. I've said publicly, without any hesitation, the Soviet Union is historical Russia. It happened, then it ceased to exist. And I want to emphasize that we have always respected the process in civilization that took place in the post-Soviet space. So, Stephen, it seems it's pretty clear that President Putin has not shifted at all. So what do you say to Ivana and to Anne, who say this whole idea about a negotiated end to the war is just a waste of time?
Well, I have 2 points to raise in reaction to Ivana's and Anne's comments. The first, I think, addresses, one source of Anne's confusion, as she put it, which is how diplomacy works and negotiated agreements work. They don't consist of unreciprocated steps. So there's no diplomatic scenario in which the Ukrainians stop fighting and the Russians continue to fight. It's either both sides stop or neither side stops. That's how these arrangements are done. And nobody is thinking of anything different. I don't know of a single analyst or observer or commentator who has even broached the idea of an unreciprocated ceasefire whereby the Ukrainians stand down and the Russians keep fighting. So I think that's, you know, that's just sort of a straw man and avoids the real issue, which I think we all agree on, which is that negotiations are essential. Secondly, I think Putin would like to wipe Ukraine off the map. There's no question about it. But the Russians have taken quite a beating in Ukraine. And they have good reasons, I think, some serious incentives to engage in a diplomatic process. Now, when one says, well, they're not interested and they'll never do it, I mean, my response is, well, how do you know? So the head of government makes extreme statements and so forth in order to justify something that he's done, and express maybe his own deep inner conviction. But you don't know whether they're willing to negotiate until there's a probe. And that's the function of diplomacy and diplomats and negotiating processes.
Let me ask you one thing. The fact that the 2024 election is coming and Vladimir Putin knows that there may be an entirely different leader of the United States just incentivize him to dig in and wait.
Well, that's got to be a factor. That's got to be a factor. And the thing is that the pressure on the Russians is going to be maintained in Ukraine until the Russians decide that they're willing to negotiate. So, regardless of what their hopes are for the return of a Trump administration that would be very friendly to Russia and its objectives and so forth, he still has 2 years that he's got to deal with. And that's plenty of time to see if, the pressure on Russia results in an interest in negotiations. But again, we won't know that until we try.
And we talked about the fear that some in the West have about the declining interest in this war. Do you share that fear? Do you think that that will make it harder to make the case that victory is the only solution, a clear victory is the only solution?
I mean, of course there will be declining interest, as there was declining interest in Afghanistan, although we did stay in Afghanistan for many, many years, even though it wasn't on the front pages anymore. So the question you're asking is really whether you need full-time 100% public interest in order to continue for the United States to continue helping the Ukrainians. I'm not sure that is necessary. Secondly, it's kind of a strange question for journalists to ask. I mean, surely it's our responsibility as people who are trying to communicate with the public to tell people why it's interesting or why it's important or why it's important to keep some policymakers focused on it. It's not the only thing we have to talk about. I mean, nationally, there are many other issues. There are many pressing issues. There are many economic issues that will move people more over the coming months. But that doesn't, I don't see why that means we have to take our eye off the ball in a conflict that could eventually affect close American allies and American interests in Europe.
Stephen, I want to give you the last word. What do you think about the fear about declining interest? Does that make it harder to come to a solution, whether it's the kind Anne wants or the kind that you say is the most viable?
I think it certainly will create problems. And not just in the U.S., but primarily in Western Europe, where this is a serious economic issue, particularly owing to the energy dimension of it. And it's the Europeans that need to prepare for a next phase, whatever a post-Ukraine phase and relations with Russia.
Stephen Simon is the Robert E. Willem Fellow at MIT's Center for International Studies. Thank you so much for joining us. And Anne Applebaum is a historian, staff writer at The Atlantic, and senior fellow at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies. Thank you for joining us as well. I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Susan Fournier, Alan Questrom Professor, and Dean.
So let's start this conversation with the title of the show, Is Business Broken? It's a provocative title and a question. Where did this come from? Why that question now?
We're in a big cultural moment where capitalism, business, market systems are really being scrutinized and debated, and the role of business with it. So I think the question is just on the table. It's on people's minds. It's in the news media. It's in conversations. I think there are growing voices, loud voices, especially among young people who seem increasingly to believe that business and maybe capitalism with it are harmful and create rather than solve problems for society. And what we do seem to hear are those loud voices, and they are very black and white. There are protagonists and the antagonists and the pros and the cons, and there's really no middle discussion. It's sort of like people for and against, and it's loud.
Right. For and against DEI, for instance, right? A battle at play.
Right.
The way you describe it and the way you describe the polarization, it makes it feel like very much of the digital age, right? It feels very much of today. Some of those arguments have been around, though, right? Is this criticism of business and this question, is business broken, is that a new question?
You are so right. It is not a new question. Schumpeter, he was a professor at Harvard, and he's also maybe one of the most influential political economists of the early 20th century. He called for the death of capitalism, the death of business, 100 years ago.
Okay. Wow.
And when he critiqued way back then, he said the very successes of capitalism would bring about its downfall because it would create values hostile to capitalism, and that this would particularly take hold among intellectuals who were critiquing. So there's a lot of that same kind of dynamic happening today, and that's 100 years old. But yeah, we've seen this kind of cultural fervor playbook many times in the past, often precipitated by big crises.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.